Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. In the 53 years since Twyla Tharp founded her eponymous dance company, she's become one of the most influential choreographers in the world. She's created more than 160 works, including full-length ballets, individual dances, Broadway shows, movies, TV specials, even figure skating routines that have expanded the boundaries of ballet and modern dance. Among her many awards are a Tony, 2 Emmys, the National Medal of the Arts, the Kennedy Center Honor, the Jerome Robbins Prize, 19 honorary doctorates, and a MacArthur Fellowship. She's currently premiering a program called Minimalism in Me that looks back on the early years of her career. It's at the Joyce Theater in Chelsea, but unfortunately, its run ends this coming Sunday, December 9th. I'm thrilled that it brings Twyla Tharp to our show. Hi, good to see you.
Thank you very much.
Now, Minimalism in Me is a kind of illustrated lecture in which you talk about how you started out and with your company performing excerpts from works that you made in the years 1965 to 1971. Why did you decide to revisit those early works?
Because, obviously, audiences, young audiences who never saw those pieces come in on a new piece I might be working on, and don't know where it started. And feel as though they're coming in the middle of an act, and nobody likes coming in the middle of a movie. So I figure, well, I better go back and put up the title and the credits and get some of the first scenes in there.
So do you see a through line from the beginning to where you are now?
Totally. It was always about beginning with minimal necessities, getting to the basics, getting to fundamentals, and then building step by step by step until things could be accommodated rather than, as an artist, jumping in over my head.
Well, when you say minimalist, when you were starting out, many of your neighbors were artists who we would call minimalist: Barnett Newman, Agnes Martin, Ellsworth Kelly. Did that inspire you as a dancer?
I think probably more the fact that I'm a Quaker and that I'm very pragmatic about things, and also an art historian. I graduated in art history, so that I look at paintings and art structurally, how's it built, how's it made. My father was a mechanic, could take things apart, nuts and bolts. I wanted to know how are things made. So I started at the beginning, which, as I say in the show, actually even predates Barnett Newman, in that Nut is an Egyptian icon constructed solely of a horizontal and a vertical. Mm.
But were you aware at the time that you were talking to artists who would become some of the most influential
of
their time?
Yeah, Barnett Newman was already, as we say, God. This was no given. Stella, Carl Andre, Hollis Frampton were very, very good friends, smart guys, figured like, yeah, they're going somewhere. Mm.
You talk about
Stella already owned the building, so we knew he counted.
Frank Stella owned the building.
He on Walker Street, not on Franklin. He owned a building.
You talk about yourself in this presentation in the third person.
I do.
She did this. She did that.
Wasn't that clever of me to come around to that? Don't you think?
Why not the first person?
Are you
embarrassed to say I?
Three. No. The shehood is a new element in the show. It's only been in for 2 nights. Up until then, it was I and me, and it's both a bit uncomfortable and a bit dishonest because me is not me 53 years ago. It is a different character. Also, the distance, the objectivity, the theatrical distance you can gain by thinking of yourself differently than personally. It's why Robert Zimmerman became Bob Dylan. Mm-hmm. You can take a totally look different at yourself. So in deciding to employ she rather than me throughout the course of the thing, when she fucks up,
messes up.
Yes, thank you. I was looking there. When she messes up, we can all laugh at her. We're not going to laugh at her if it's me who messes up. They're not going. Audiences would be embarrassed to laugh at me, but they'll laugh at she.
But when you think back to that time, do you think of yourself as being somebody different than who you are now?
I think that what I said in the introduction of She last night, which you heard, which will be different tonight because I'm still working on this text, I do state that the me who became committed as an artist is a different persona than the regular mortal who would not have that kind of commitment. So there was a distance. And always also, I look at a lot of video, and I always say, I always refer to myself in video as she.
Mm-hmm.
Always. It's never me. It's always she.
You mentioned that you're still working on it, even though this run at the Joyce ends this coming Sunday. Are you planning to take it elsewhere?
We open in Boston at the ICA the middle of next week for a run.
In your speech, you tell us that you graduated from Barnard in 1963, obviously an art history major, and then moved into a loft on Franklin Street in Lower Manhattan.
Yep.
And that was the reason that so many artists were there, was because the rents were cheap?
There was no rent. It was $50 a month. And there was real space. It was raw space, but it was open space. Open space is very different from an apartment. And also there is an attraction to living where you work. And it's a part of the she-dom, if you will. You're allowed to go responsibly into this committed area called being an artist because it's your living room.
Now, we mentioned that the artists that you were meeting there were minimalists. This was a time when a bunch of artists were reacting against the dominance of the abstract expressionist movement.
Right.
Now, how did that apply at all to dance?
I am not a dance historian. In my familiarity with dance of the day, I think probably not since Euripides and Dionysian Bacchals did we have real abstract expressionism.
But it's interesting, minimalism also was taking place in music with composers like Philip Glass and Steve Reich.
Mm-hmm.
I guess it was the zeitgeist at that moment.
Yeah, Terry Riley, even before Phil and Terry, it was NC was something that I've known from the get-go and always responded to. There's something both reassuring and challenging in that much simplicity.
You studied with Martha Graham, Merce Cunningham, danced with the Paul Taylor Company before you founded your own company. Those are three of the greatest choreographers of all time. Were your early works influenced by their styles?
I was very lucky. The congruency, and Eric also, Nikolai also.
Alwyn Nikolai,
yeah.
Wow.
I made a point when I was in college. Basically, I transferred from whatever major I came here in from Pomona College as a midterm sophomore, dumped that, and took up art history so I could cram slides on the weekends because I went to no classes and was taking dancing exposure lessons everywhere I could, two classes a day. That's what I was doing. So I was very fortunate that there was the variety and the depth of work going on. And yes, the influence is intense, not necessarily in terms of the work itself, but in terms of the commitment. When you went into the studio for the morning class, you knew Martha was already in there. You knew it because there was a red ribbon tied around the handles on the door, which meant Martha is working, be quiet.
Mm-hmm.
And she would always beat you in. Merce would always beat you in. They were there. They were working.
Well, we mentioned that minimalist painting was a reaction to abstract expressionists. When you started doing your own work, did you see yourself as having to distinguish yourself from them, kind of do something different in rebellion?
No, it wasn't about rebellion. It was about being honest. It was about being in a place that I could define and respect as my own beginning. I would have felt that using the Graham technique or the Cunningham technique was fraudulent because I was not them. Not that I didn't have the highest regard and love for them. I did. And they were both amazing teachers. However, I would have felt dishonest starting from their base. So I was searching for my own base. And one of the reasons I studied as much as I did before I began to work was to eliminate. When I worked with Milos Forman on Hair, Milos would say, okay, this I worked on writing the script. We did this for a year before we shot. And he'd say, come.
You wrote it as well?
He worked on the Michael Weller is given the credit, but Milos really is the one. I didn't write the script, but Milos wanted me to come to meetings because I might be useful. A clever man, with a production idea here or there, which I was. The horses are my idea. But in any case, Milos would screen musicals while we were working on the script, like My Fair Lady, which was a particular favorite because it was a huge bestseller. And he'd say, look, we're looking at these not for what to do, but for what not to do. Not because they hadn't been successful, but they had. And Milos knew that success was not in repeating those who had already been there. It was in finding another way to do it.
And Hair was a success.
Hair was a success.
The program at the Joyce includes your first work called Tank Dive from 1965. Was that your first attempt at choreography?
It was my first piece. I intended it to count. I filmed it. Robert Berry, who was also a minimalist working at the time, and we filmed it at Hunter. 2 days after it was done and over, we went in with the cameras because I figured, well, this is the first one. We better get it down.
It's set to the song Downtown by Petula Clark. Was setting a modern dance to a pop song considered radical in those days?
It was not a good idea. That was like really bad taste, yes.
Why did you choose that song? Was it just a favorite?
No, because it has a viscera to it. I have a musical background. My mother was a concert pianist. I started keyboard lessons outside the house when I was 2 years old. I played viola. I played percussion. I've had an incredible musical education. And I learn many, many things from music, and it's a great companion for me. And I have an interior resonance zone where a piece of music dances, and if it dances, I go with it. Downtown dances. I wasn't thinking about is it good, bad, indifferent, pop music, whatever. It danced. I put up a dancer doing nothing.
I've always wondered whether choreographers to some degree are responding to how, if they're using music, how the music affects their own sense of body as opposed to the people they're working with.
Yes. For me, I can only speak for myself. I have to have a gut connection to the music. It has to really drive something that is nonverbal. And then I will also want to learn as much about that particular piece of music and study it, again, in order not to duplicate it, not to replicate it, but either to move in tandem or in juxtaposition to what it's intending.
Tank Dive is quite minimal.
I think so, yes.
A single dancer comes out and holds a relevé pose for 3.5 minutes, the length of the song Downtown.
Correct.
Were you thinking of the dancer yourself as a kind of sculpture?
No, because sculptures, the tension involved in holding that relevé is very difficult, actually. And it was finding it wasn't so much the word minimalism as the absolute fundamental. I mean, there are those who search for the first chair. What was the first chair? It was a rock. Okay. Mm-hmm. So I was looking for something that basic, and I figured nobody is going to have used this as a base. I think I'll put it down, and this is going to be it. And from here, it can only go up.
So you premiered it at Hunter College,
yes,
in the art department,
yes,
and then went on to Judson Church, the Metropolitan Museum, and other venues. Was there any response? Did critics say, hey, there's this new girl in town?
That no one came to the first concert, even though I sent out flyers, I built the costume, et cetera, et cetera. The second performance, yeah, the New York Times was there. As I say in the lecture, Barnes did write a review. And he said something to the effect in it that Miss Tharp has a smile that would freeze a Frigidaire or something to that effect. Clive was always
Did you take that as a compliment?
No, I didn't take it as a non-compliment because he was never snarky. He was witty. And it gave you something to think about. Well, gee, yeah, okay, well, but you know, Clive, I want you to like what I'm not doing. It's not about liking me as a person because I'm a smiler. It's because I'm an artist of first caliber that you need to love me. I'll smile later.
Is this the first time you've revived this piece?
Yeah. It's the first time any of these pieces have been put back up because, frankly, disregarding their intense illustrations and documentation, you really couldn't put them back. We, if we killed ourselves, might be able to put them back together. Some of them, not all of them. But Tank Dive has never been put up before. The thing called Removes has never been put up before. None of them. Medley hasn't even been reconstructed. It should be. The Flash Mob piece, the museum piece that went up in the Met will never be reconstructed. The IBM 360-44, the computer piece that was built at Oberlin, will never go up.
I'm speaking with Twyla Tharp, whose new program called Minimalism and Me is currently at the Joyce Theater on, now I'm trying to remember, that's on 6th Avenue.
It's on 8th Avenue.
And
right. 19th Street.
Right.
Not quite.
A wonderful little theater. It used to be a movie revival house. Mm-hmm. But is it good for dance?
Well, it has its difficulties. It was designed as a movie house.
Uh-huh. But there's been a lot of dance there in the last 25, 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
What's it like to revisit early works? Are there things that you feel you would do differently if you were creating them now?
No, I'm not a revisionist. I did them for a purpose at the time, and because the whole context is so different, I wouldn't pretend to know what the hell I was doing. So there'd be no point in trying to make changes. Going back is a strange thing. Going to the past, using the past, how do we approach the past? I'm working on a book. It will come out next year, I promise. Simon & Schuster, and it deals with this issue. How do we deal with the past? How do we keep from being sentimental, from being sucked into it, from feeling guilty that we didn't, when wanting to go back and revise, simply allow it to be and move on from there, which was one of the big reasons for doing this piece, because essentially I made the past into a new beast by giving it a new context. I gave it a direction to go in that when these pieces were being built, she had no idea where she was going.
She didn't.
She
But when a dance is then performed by some other dancer, yes, years later, it has to change, doesn't it?
Yes and no. We're relentless. We are ruthless in the official reconstructions, which begin with the fugue. I mean, the annotation on the fugue, and we're working on several systems, which we use academically as well, to make certain that this particular, you know, Model T Ford, let's say, has all the exact right pieces so that when it's rebuilt 50 years from now, it will be a real Model T Ford. Will it be done differently? Yes and no. I mean, every dancer, particularly with the living art forms, I mean, every dancer, every musician is very different, but the box score does not change.
Although dance changes less than, let's say, the performance of a theater piece, where a different actor automatically will make the part his or her own.
Depends on the director.
Many of your early works were staged in gymnasiums, malls, parks, museums. Why not theaters?
Well, as I say in the text, we weren't invited. Nobody was inviting us to work in their stages. You couldn't just walk into a theater. So in order to be able to put up the work and give it to a public, we had to just go outside and do it.
Were there even any theaters that were presenting dance?
No.
Lincoln Center wasn't completed at that point.
It wasn't. And there were not the programs, there were not the presenters. I mean, I would go to, say, Wagner College, which is in Staten Island, and they have a gymnasium. And I'd say, well, we have a piece we would really like to perform. Can we use your gymnasium? And they would say, okay. And that's how it was
done.
So
it was free?
It was free.
And also, perhaps because it was, it wasn't a traditional place, you could do all sorts of things that you might not do with a regular theater, with a proscenium arch?
There were no expectations and there were no obligations. Having sold no tickets, we didn't know anybody, an entertaining evening. We could simply present what we thought was appropriate, and the audience could simply leave if it wished.
So you didn't charge admission?
Never. No admission.
Did you just want to get it out in the world
yes.
and get some reaction to
yes,
it?
Yes, because as I say again, one requires the resonance. You want to know, basically you want to know, am I communicating? Am I just, dicking around here? Or am I saying something that means something to somebody else? And if so, how are they perceiving it? What can I learn from how they are processing the information?
And who were your audiences? Artists, students, intellectuals, downtown types?
All the above. All the above. Whoever came through the mailings that happened. Obviously, we couldn't afford any advertising. We could do postings. And the Village Voice might have done listings also. I couldn't be wrong about that.
But you didn't get reviews other than the Clive Barnes?
No, we did. We were reviewed basically by anybody who was writing, and that was not many people. There were reviewers. Where else? I mean, there was something called Ballet Review.
Mm-hmm. And how were you received? Because you were doing something that was out of the ordinary.
I think that critics, reviewers in those days were curious, perhaps less judgmental. Didn't have to be entertaining, the magic word snark here, simply were being observers. If you remember Jill Johnson, for The Voice, she tried to be very literal in her description. This is what happened. Not, I had this for breakfast and I don't feel so well, or I have this particular vendetta or whatever. It wasn't that. It was what she saw. And I think that the reviewers in that era were much more about that kind of thing. It hadn't been the sort of playoff that it can become. It was simply allowing a person to work and being genuinely curious about what are they doing.
So do you miss that approach?
I do.
Even though you still get great reviews.
Thank you. I appreciate that. We do appreciate great reviews, but we also appreciate an honest review that is written simply by somebody who is looking at the thing and saying, this is important to me for this reason, or this is not making it through to me for this reason.
Well, we know from the history of art that things that we now consider to be absolutely great weren't always considered great. Caravaggio, Vermeer, they went centuries, totally obscure.
I know.
The other day we talked about Pontormo, uh-huh. another artist who was
beautiful,
wonderful, but for years totally forgotten.
Yep. Well, this is true in all art forms, and literature, music, certainly. I mean, Schubert. Poor Schubert. There's always the historical redemption, as we might call it. Unfortunately, that does not pay the bills for now.
You mentioned Medley before. That's from 1969, originally staged in an open field an hour before sunset. It had to be an hour before sunset?
Mm-hmm.
Was that a reference to your childhood, which was spent partly on your grandparents' farm in Indiana?
Not so much. We wanted to do something in the open air. By then, we wanted to be centrally located. We wanted to draw as large an audience as we could. And it was an hour before sunset because that was free lighting. So we continued to work into dusk and dark with a section that was built to kind of evaporate along with the quality of the light. So we always tried to maximize the specifics of the location where we were.
So can you perform it indoors?
No. It couldn't be done indoors. Excerpts can be done indoors, but it couldn't be done indoors. The intention of it was to sit well where it was located. And that is true of all of these environmental pieces, which taught me a great deal.
So, like artists, you were also doing site-specific pieces.
That would be true.
A piece from 1965 called Stage Show, sadly not included in this program, is described as a sort of furry hoochie-coochie with dancers using paws from a bearskin rug.
Yes.
It was performed outside the Alaska Pavilion at the New York World's Fair.
Yes, twice. Right. All we remember is the furry claws. That's all we can remember. Sorry,
so
we can't help
filmed?
You out there.
Because a lot of these things were filmed.
Hold on. Mm-hmm. The Hoochie Cooch thing was about getting audiences into the Alaskan Pavilion. That's what I was thinking there. And that's what I'm not sure that the movement did as well to describe our intention as the language did. What did you ask after that?
I can't even remember. But I'm curious about the titles because one of them has a really long title, Dancing in the Streets of London and Paris, Continued in Stockholm and Sometimes in Madrid. And that was performed in the Metropolitan Museum of Art.
Yeah, it was also done at the Wadsworth Athenaeum.
I asked you about filming and...
We'll get back to that. Yeah. The intention of that title was, me as the PR person, I'm promoting it for European tours, everybody. That was the thinking there. In terms of filming, no. I got a secondhand video system in 68. I got a secondhand Panasonic deck, which weighed about 75 pounds. The separate camera weighed about 60 pounds. The Wallensack for the sound you had to carry separately. The tripod weighed a ton, okay? And I managed
to... Now you do it on your iPhone.
But in 68, I knew that I wanted to be able to record the actual work, which was what was being done in the studio. There was not availability for this. This was not done. Even to get a recording of a performance, our first one was The Fugue, I think, which actually there are bits and snippets of medley. We do have that in film. It was not matter of course that this thing happened. You had to set up separate shoots. People was not assumed that that was going to be the case. I did it as an art historian. I wanted a document of at least a little tiny smidge in this. I wanted evidence.
How did you get the Metropolitan Museum of Art, not generally considered cutting edge, to allow you
Henry
to do
Geltzeller.
That?
Do you remember Geltzeller?
Yes.
Talk about him. He was a good one.
Mm-hmm.
Geltzeller got us in.
So he went against the image of the museum, but he was one of the greatest curators that ever lived.
He put his neck on the line to get us in.
Where did some of the ideas of these early dances come from? Were they inspired by things like gym exercises, boxing moves, computer programs?
We couldn't afford any of that at that time. We had space, and we worked all the time. It was in working, as I'm sure you know, anyone who makes anything knows that in the working, questions arise, things become important, there become connections, form begins to take place. That's how it was done. It was not done to satisfy a product. Commercial work was a concept that came much, much later. Commercial work, you're expected to do what the product requires.
And that's why you say at one point, you could be shocking, but not entertaining.
Yes, that's a good line, isn't it? No, that was
part of the minimalist credo.
Yes, that's the avant-garde. That's the entertainment would be cheap, selling out. I've had that accusation many times. I don't see it that way. I see it as another opportunity to learn. But the idea of something needing to be shocking, épater la bourgeoisie, had Flaubert, not Flaubert, Baudelaire. You had to be different. You had to be other than. I'm not always interested in other than. I'm sometimes very interested in related to.
But that's perhaps one of the reasons your dancers didn't where the kinds of things we associate with dancers, leotards, they wore street clothes.
Right.
And in one piece, Removes from 1966, a dancer walks across the stage putting one foot in front of the other. Was the title a kind of a play on words? Were you attempting to remove most of the elements of dance from
it
the
was
work?
It was dual. One being removes being repetitive over and over and over and over again, which seems oxymoronic in relation to its other meaning, which is to take away. So it seemed mutually exclusive, these words, and that seemed like a really good thing for minimalism because then they would block each other out. Mostly it did have to do with the element of moving, where you could either repeat it or you could reduce it to its absolute basics. So essentially when I say we were measuring the space of the sanctuary area was a rectangle, and we did that by the most primitive measurement known to mankind, the length of a foot.
Mm-hmm. In those early days, wasn't your company composed of all women?
All women.
So did you see this as a feminist statement?
Well, I don't think we thought we were making a political statement. I think we were being realistic is what we thought. We were the best dancers we could find. Mm-hmm. Men who danced as well as we were generally considered enormously valuable to companies, and they could afford to pay them. We couldn't. Nobody got paid anything for 5 years. We're doing all of this, but women would work hard. And it was also perhaps the notion that we could do it all. We could jump. We could lift. We could do what needed to be done, and we didn't want the imposition of, oh, that's what the guy does, to be set on the work. We wanted to do what we could do to the max.
At the Joyce, you have a company of three men and three women performing these works. Can all of your works be performed by dancers of either sex?
No. Those pieces, the early pieces, did not involve intense partnering. Something like Nine Sinatra Songs, which has a lot of conventional expanded ballet and traditional moves. I mean, I have done weight training, you need to know my dead weight record. Don't you want to know?
Sure.
227 pounds.
Wow.
Hello, waist height, body weight for three on the bench. So I have learned how to work and counterbalance and how to leverage weight.
I'm not going to arm wrestle with you.
No, you wouldn't want to. But the at that time, we didn't do a lot of partnering. Partnering was one of the things that I came to learn, one of the basics, one of the fundamentals, one of the minimal things we did. For about 2.5 years, there was no partnering. In fact, when the dancers in medley laid down a couple of people at one point, that was the first partnered move, and that was like 4 years later. There was no partnering.
Also, after Tank Dive, most of the early works didn't include music. Was that part of the minimalist aesthetic?
For me, that was, again, it was a learning procedure. As I said, I was privileged to have an extraordinary background in musical composition as well as practice. I worked inside string quartets. I'd had the viola as well as violin and learned how the two tones work differently. And I knew and I know the power of music.
I'd imagine it's harder for a dancer to perform without music.
And, well, hold on, but righteousness. There's a righteousness to both musical structure and dance. I knew that if I put on music, people are much more comfortable responding emotionally to sound than they are to sight. And that the same piece of dancing with a romantic piece of music would be received in one way, with a modern is a totally different way. Happy music, happy dance. Sad music, sad dance. I wanted to know what does the movement do. So I kept the music out.
But what about the dancers? Do they have to keep time in their heads?
Yes. You see an example of that in the fugue. People always are amazed that these dancers can hold the tight counterpoint they do with no musical construct. Again, it's to sell dance very short because, might I point out, no music is ever created until we have movement first, and that the rhythm of music actually comes from movement, that some of Beethoven's rhythms came from stumbles in his walking procedure when he's writing down his music every day, new melodies are coming in, he's stumbling, whatever. His movement is impacting on his rhythm. No one, for the most part, understands that dance controls rhythm. So, yes, but back to the dancers, yes, they know, and at one point in the fugue, they count out one, two, three. They don't need to count out one, two, three, four. You need to hear that they have that capacity, that they know exactly where they are, and it's a capacity that the human machine, that the body has, and it's incredibly intelligent. It's not given the credit it should be given, the human body.
We should point out that the fugue is based on a piece by Bach, but without the music.
Without the Bach, right.
The only sounds that are those of the dancers' feet hitting the stage and hand slapping parts of their bodies. In a way, it's a percussive piece.
It is. It is. But there's also a legato element to it. What you're seeing in this particular show is only half the fugue. And there are other phrases that are used in the fugue that are not percussive, that are lyric phrases.
Was that the first of your works that was licensed to be performed by other companies?
Probably.
I'm speaking with Twyla Tharp. Her current program, Minimalism and Me, is at the Joyce Theater. And you have to run to see it because the run, different use of the word,
that's
run,
fine.
Ends this coming Sunday, December 9th. We are back with Twyla Tharp talking about your early career. Do you ever plan to do another one, a mid-career program?
Do I ever plan to do another early career? I like that question better. There have been suggestions that perhaps there are extensions of this. Actually, I've had a request for the period from the Bix through to Baker's Dozen, which is Beiderbecke through to Willie Smith. The music that I used during the first, I don't know, 5 or 6, 7 years, is all early American music, and I used it basically chronologically, from Jelly Roll Morton going on up into...
We just heard some Jelly Roll.
Yep, going on up into later great American left-hand keyboard guys, Willie Smith.
And so a lot
Bats
of jazz.
Waller.
We go from Petula Clark to all these great jazz musicians.
I think of them actually as classical musicians. I think that they thought of, Joplin, for example, very much thought of himself as a classical composer, and I would agree with him. Jazz, yeah, did they have a good time? Yeah. Were they pulling out of the air in a way? I mean, were they getting out of the vernacular, let's say, a great deal of energy and so forth? Yeah. Were they all phenomenally grounded classical musicians? Yeah.
Hmm. Do you see dancers working to music as a kind of a conversation?
I do. And it's a dialogue where sometimes I see the music as scenery. Sometimes I see it definitely as atmosphere setting. Sometimes I see it as a percussive bass that can be embellished. Sometimes definitely a dialogue can be very romantic, might we even say sexy, to have that kind of correspondence. What's less so is when it's redundant and is simply repetitive of what's underneath. And it's not easy to get away from that because music is very, very powerful. And when, in any case, I feel as though I'm being pulled into its sphere too strongly, I have to back it up.
Another one of your early works called After Suite refers to Merce Cunningham's Suite for Five in Space and Time. Mm-hmm. Was it a way for you to interpret your teacher's work and turn it into something personal?
No, I didn't know Suite. I must have seen it once or I doubt even twice, but Viola Farber and Carolyn Brown, who were in Merce's original company, were also fantastic teachers. And I knew Merce's vocabulary more through the classroom than I did through the stage. And so the title's a tribute to him and to what he offered to all dancers, both technically as performers as well as choreographers.
Might he have seen it?
He might have. He came to a rehearsal one time. He came and he sat in the corner and then he stood up and he went, and neither he nor I ever saw appropriate to ask the other what they thought, which was fine by me because his simply coming was an enormous extension of support.
I asked a couple of times what inspires each dance, but I think that discussing the dances explains it just in the process. The idea for one of the dances we see here called Disperse came from the dichotomy paradox of the Greek philosopher Zeno.
Mm-hmm.
Now, were you thinking about how mathematics could be translated into movement?
No, I was really thinking about energy and the notion that that a commodity can be subdivided infinite number of times, but it can never be totally eradicated. To me, that's hope. To me, that's faith. To me, that's power. It's strength. And it's also the idea of diminishment and increase. And that's something we can dance. I do be a little sarcastic in some of my language when I say the handmaiden of philosophy, which is a line I quite like, but it's not really true. Because whenever you move, you are bringing something to language that it doesn't have. Otherwise, you're bringing a proof to language. Otherwise, it doesn't have.
We talked about minimalism and the art aspect of minimalism. Are we now moving on to conceptualism with something like this?
We do in the lecture. We do go there. And conceptualism is rather difficult to illustrate through the body since basically it's an activity of the mind and concept. And often for the dancer, it also is something to be minimalized, shall we say. It's fine to think you're doing something. It's fine to say you're doing something. Now let's see it.
The history of Up and Down from 1971 was originally staged at Oberlin College while you were 7 months pregnant.
That is true.
And here we see a man performing it with a mm-hmm. pillow tied around his waist.
Yes. Rather
a joke.
No. A brilliant introduction to the entire dilemma of sexism and gender politics. Excuse me, not a joke.
Well,
okay?
Witty. We'll call it witty.
No, not even witty. Necessary, because you're about to see in 8 Jelly Rolls 3 men dancing roles that were done by women. Mm. How are we going to justify this? Therefore, what we must show is the conversion of a man to a woman. Now, Dibble is a classic. He has a great classical technique. He was trained at the Royal. He went through the entire White Lodge syllabus, so he has very, very strong feet. In giving him this role as a pregnant woman early, before he's going to be seen in 8 Jelly Rolls, no longer pregnant, but still in a role originally done by a woman, not necessarily. It's rather neuter, but the pregnant woman is not. And Dibble worked very hard. He said, well, and suddenly he became aware of this responsibility the pillow represented that's strapped to his midsection as he's doing this phrase, and became very touching.
And it's
because, let me finish, because yeah. I want to give credit to the male gender. It doesn't happen that often.
I really appreciate that.
You're welcome. So that he developed a tenderness towards this responsibility. He said, how did you not jolt? I said, Dibble, I used my releve. Come on, you have strong feet. You always go through the metatarsal. You never jolt into the heel. And then he started working at the dancing completely differently. And when he starts traveling it in space, it is very moving, the concern that he shows for this other entity that's attached to him. It's very moving. I could perhaps do classes for men.
It's set to
in maledom.
It's set to music by Willie the Lion Smith, Jelly Roll Morton, and Rufus Thomas.
Yes, yes.
Walking the Dog fame.
Yes.
So you had given up your new music approach by this time.
Oh, you mean bump, bop, 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 bop. No, I never used bop, 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 bop. That came much later. I commissioned Phil Glass to do the In the Upper Room score, but not until the 80s. I never used bop, 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 bop. Ever up until that piece.
Well, we mentioned Jelly Roll Morton. The second half of the program is devoted to a piece called 8 Jelly Rolls from 1971, set to music by Jelly Roll Morton. Did that represent a real change for you?
That was huge. And it was a little, I went, are you kidding? You're selling out? Like, you're going to put music on stage at the same time as the dancing.
And a proscenium stage.
And a proscenium stage with entrances and exits. This is a real step back, girl. What are you, have you chickened out just because you got to pay for diapers? No. Is that what we're looking at here? And to some degree, yes, that was what we were looking at here. But on the other hand, what we were also looking at here was the realization that life is both pretty funny and pretty absurd. And who understood this really well were the silent clowns, and Buster Keaton is a great favorite.
And the piece has narrative, humor, sensuous movement, very entertaining.
Oh, yes.
You performed it at the Delacorte Theater in Central Park. So
that was
a prestigious I mean, it's still a prestigious place to perform.
Yes.
Was that the largest audience you'd had up to that point?
Probably. Probably was.
And was that the moment when you gave up minimalism?
If you remember, in the first piece, there's a solo downstage that was originally done by a very large, no, she wasn't that very large, but she was our largest one, called Big Rose. She wasn't really 6 foot. I say she was, but she wasn't really quite. And towards two-thirds of the way through, upstage, Sarah and I made a crossover once, and we made a crossover twice. And I realized, before we came out for that single crossover at that first performance at the Delacorte, all right, this is either it or it isn't. And it turned out to be it.
I hope it's not giving too much away to say that you also dance in this program. Many dancers reach an age when they feel they can't perform anymore. Have you?
That's because they're reasonable, sensitive human beings who are somewhat, you know, self-maligning, et cetera, et cetera. Look, I've always danced. Whether I performed or not was to me often irrelevant, because I was dancing to make stronger and better dancers and stronger and better dances, not for myself as a performer. In this instance, yes, Paul died. And Paul
Taylor.
Yes,
he died a few years back.
No, he died a few months back.
Oh, okay.
He, and it was for me a moment of understanding. He was the last of the mentors. He was the last one out front. He was the last windbreaker. And I realized that I'd been leaving this responsibility here, and that I was going to have to step up to the plate. So I, in a way, came out of my innuendo zone and did what I can do. And the reality is, Merce stayed on stage quite a long while, but he had very, very, very bad knees from a lot of different reasons. Had he had the opportunity for medical attention that is available now, it would have been a different story for Merce. And that is an element that is a part of our history and is a part of who we are as physical beings, and that allows me to do something he would have done. So in a way, I do it. In a way, I do it for him.
I won't reveal your age, but you've
performing
for more than 50 years.
Yes, it's there. It's right there. 77 fucking years right there. Yep.
But have you, the wear and tear on your body has not been as bad as with some dancers?
There's wear and tear on the body, but there's also strengthening of the body. Also, because I make dances rather than needing to perform the roles that others assign me, I can do what my body is prepared to do. I don't have to do what it's told to do. So along the way, when it was no longer appropriate for me to be doing a full bar, I didn't have to stop dancing. Mm-hmm. I started weight training instead, or boxing instead, something where I could still be very functional, even though the deep plie was not going to be happening.
You've also created works for many other companies, including the Joffrey Ballet, American Ballet Theater, the Paris Opera Ballet, the Royal Ballet, the New York City Ballet, the Boston Ballet, the Australian Ballet, and the Martha Graham Dance Company. Mm-hmm. How do you go about creating a work for another company like the Joffrey or the Martha Graham Company? Is the process the same as working with your own group?
No, because they're not the same dancers. They're not trained the same way. They don't think the same way. They don't experience delight and non-delight in the same way. You have to learn to translate what you understand to them. I always say with a dancer, I go halfway, you come halfway. You don't have to come all the way to me to do what I do. I need to understand you. So in the instance of Graham, when Martha passed, I went to the studio and I gave them a piece, and I had the value of classes, her technique classes, from Martha herself, and no one in her company at that time had. And I said, look, guys, the only price here, the only charge for this piece, is that you have to bring in Yuriko to teach an original technique class, because that's the Graham technique I know. I will work through that original vocabulary, not the one that it has altered during the last 30 years, 35 years.
But you're really creating a Martha Graham piece.
Yes, but I'm not Martha, and I don't have her concerns, and all things are different, but still, I know her technique and can utilize it in my my own way, perhaps, but I can ground a dancer in the Graham technique who is not classic ballet trained. A ballet dancer, I'm not going to ask them to do a Graham-driven kind of fundamentally grounded, powerful movement. They don't know how to use isometrics in the same way. They're much lighter, higher. Different kind of dancing, different dancer, different dancing.
So dance has changed a lot over the course of...
No, the vocabularies are different. They're different languages. The so-called modern techniques are very different from the classical. Have the techniques evolved? Yes. Ordinarily with the modern companies, the Cunningham technique, the Graham technique, they don't really evolve past the originator. The ballet technique has been evolving for the last 300 years. So you have movement that glissade today is very different from a glissade, you know, when Louis XIV was doing them in his high-heeled slippers.
Well, have the lines blurred a lot in recent years? Because it seems to me, in watching ballet, I see a lot of modern, what I would call modern dance, and modern dance often employs an awful lot of ballet.
Right.
Mark Morris loves On Point, for example.
Yes, yes. That was one of my big concerns in a piece called Deuce Coupe, which will be being actually presented at the Metropolitan Opera House this spring. It is being
not
premiered.
Little Deuce Coupe, just the regular Deuce
no,
Coupe?
No, Deuce Coupe, the ballet that was done, my very first ballet was done with the Joffrey. Five of our dancers went into the Joffrey company. They worked On Point. We didn't. The borderlines were totally drawn between we're modern dancers, you're ballet dancers. I knew the technique on the other side. I'm going, guys, come on, we can do this, but we'll for the time being allow that fence. We're going to breach the fence. A dancer is going to dance. A dancer is going to be capable of all forms of movement. It just isn't true today. It's more true this today than it was the 35 years ago or whatever the right number is when I made Deuce Coupe, and we had to have two different kinds of dancers to do two different kinds of movement. That's no longer true.
Haven't you also worked with many of the same people since the beginning? Your lighting designer, Jennifer Tipton, is credited on the 1965 premiere of Tank Dive.
That's right.
And Santo Loquastro, who designed costumes, has worked with you since 1974.
Yep.
Sarah Rudner, credited for staging this program, was a dancer in your troupe early on.
Yep.
So have you created a community of people who you trust?
I would say I have some deep friendships.
And you know that these people will understand what you're looking for.
I know these people value it and treasure it in the same way in their lives that I do.
Meanwhile, if all of this has inspired you to want to see these wonderful performances, they are at the Joyce Theater at 175 8th Avenue, unfortunately only until this Sunday. And Twyla Tharp, thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you. Pleasure.
And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Twyla Tharp, to Barbara Kahn, who produced this segment, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my producer, Jesse Lent, who is at the audio controls today.
Audit Lopate at Large comes to you
on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.